Good morning, everybody. Our share this morning is entitled The Implications of Textual Layering Within the Zohar. So we're going to look at a very interesting field of study, a very interesting methodology of the study of the Zohar. I don't know how often this has been done, but I've based myself on Professor Ronit Meroz. And what she's done is she's analyzed pericopes, small sections of the Zohar that deal with the same topic, but are presented differently, scattered throughout the entire Zohar, taken sometimes from the printed version, sometimes taken from manuscript versions of the Zohar. And these, what you could call textual units that all deal with the same theme, have been collated together and then compared to each other and then analyzed. So they would have a particular subject, let's say subject A, and every time subject A is dealt with in some section of the Zohar or in some manuscript or in any Zoharic writing, it's collected together, collated, and then analyzed to see what the differences are, and then interpreted to try and show, well, what do we learn from those differences? What do those differences indicate? So it's a very interesting way of studying the Zohar. And as a result of that, one tries to establish when was the Zohar written, how many people wrote it, et cetera, et cetera. What this research has done is it's kind of put paid to the once very binary debate over who wrote the Zohar. As you know, the debate always revolved around, was it Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai in the second century Tanna? Did he write the entire Zohar? Or was it written by... The consensus of many scholars is that it was written by Rabbi Moshe de Leon in the 13th century in Spain. He was a Spanish Kabbalist. It's often said that he forged the Zohar. We've spoken about this many times. I'm not going to go into it now. But the old debate was a very binary debate. The traditional view, of course, is that Rabbi Moshe bar Yochai wrote the entire Zohar, pretty much as we have it today, and that's it. And the scholarly debate, or the scholarly view, including many rabbis, I should add, it's not just the scholarly view, there are many, many rabbis who hold the view that the Zohar was written by Rabbi Moshe de Leon and was, in fact, a forgery. But this new research now, by dividing the Zohar into small studyable chunks, if you like, that all deal with the same topic, and then analyzing them reveals something very, very different. It reveals that the debate cannot be a binary debate anymore. It cannot just include Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai and Rabbi Moshe de Leon, because there are too many variables. So we have to, as we will see with a couple of examples, we have to conclude that there were multiple authors when it came to the Zohar, just because there's so many different versions of the same textual units, these textual layers that are all similar, that all have a common denominator, common theme. They are so varied that we have to conclude that they couldn't have been the work of one individual. And they are so variant that we also can't conclude that they were put together at one period in time, whether it was in the second century or whether it was in the 13th century. So the whole basis of the direction of the debate in the past, the binary debate, has completely changed as a result of this new methodology. So in the classical discussions over who wrote the Zohar, there's basically two views. Was it written by a single author, or was it written by multiple people? I'm just going back into how the research was done in the past. For those who held that there was a single author, they hold the single author model. There were only two candidates. It was either, as we mentioned, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai in the second century, or Rabbi Moshe de Leon in the 13th century. For those who hold that there were multiple authors, it was usually maintained that these multiple authors lived around about the time of Moshe de Leon, in other words, in the 13th century. But now with the new research from Meroz, it turns out that the period over which the Zohar would have been put together would have been from the 11th century to the 14th century, not just the 13th century. So the window has been widened considerably in favor of multiple authors, but living over a longer period of time, much longer, over a period of 300 years, which really puts pay to the notion of the Zohar being authored by one individual, whoever that individual was. But the research tends to be more to point more towards the period of Rabbi Moshe de Leon, in other words, from the 11th to the 14th century, as opposed to the 2nd century with Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. And of course, you know, we've spoken about this also many times. The language of the Zohar is not a 2nd century Aramaic, very much related to Spanish understanding of language and Spanish Aramaic at the time, and various words would not have existed in the second century, in the time of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, and there were various words that were used that would have been more fitting for the period of Rabbi Moshe de Leon. What the research also reveals is that when it comes to these multiple authors, who were these multiple authors? So one might think that they were great famous Kabbalists, but it turns out that they may not have been great famous individuals, great famous Kabbalists between the 11th and the 14th century. But it appears that there may have been small Kabbalistic circles, small and rather unknown Kabbalistic circles. In other words, not very mainstream even in Kabbalistic circles. Small groups of people. These were centers of Kabbalistic creativity. And they, over a period of a couple of centuries, there was a process of development with various of these authors adding to this mystical corpus, and then a process of editing and changing and adapting, which shows quite a considerable development process over quite a considerable period of time. But as I said, it's more towards the side, more towards the time of Moshe de Leon than to Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. But what this resource also shows is that while Moshe de Leon may have had a hand and probably did have a hand and may have even forged aspects of the Zohar, the extent of his contribution to the Zohar is now diminished. And this goes completely against things that we have said before. Even in this year, when we spoke about the origins of the Zohar, we stuck more to that binary debate. Was it Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Yochai, or was it Rabbi Moshe de Leon? We said we couldn't have been Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai for various historical reasons. It was Moshe de Leon, and we kind of left it that it was mainly Moshe de Leon who was the author, the author of the Zohar, and he forged most of the Zohar. And we brought proof from letters of his wife, who said that they were very poor. No one was reading his books. And only when he claimed that it was written by Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai did people start buying his book called the Zohar, etc., etc. But that all seems to have changed, because while the Zohar is clearly written around about the time of Moshe de Leon, and while he may have contributed, the extent of his contribution is dramatically reduced. So let's look at two examples now after that rather lengthy introduction. And let's look at two examples of these layers, these various layers of Zoharic texts on the same subject. When it comes to studying mysticism, theosophy, which is mystical philosophy, one would expect a degree of a relatively consistent degree of uniformity, because mystical ideas pretty much follow models that are accepted models. Obviously, there'd be different versions of the model, but generally speaking, the notions should be more or less the same, and one would expect a general sense of consistency. But we're going to look at two examples where that consistency, especially on important issues, on core issues, on fundamental issues, is absolutely not there, which immediately tells us that it couldn't have been written by one author and that there must have been a considerable process of development. So the first example comes from what Meroz calls the rose and its scent genre of Kabbalistic writings, of Zoharic writings. Generally speaking, mysticism is fond of the following pattern of thought, of theosophy. It presents a thesis, in other words, an idea, which is usually a spiritual energy or a spiritual concept. In our case, it's a spiritual energy. That's called the thesis. That's how we start. We start off with a certain energy, the conceptualization of a certain energy. Then immediately, we are introduced to an antithesis, where an opposing energy is discussed, and that the two energies are now existing in a state of tension. So we have our thesis and our antithesis existing in a state of tension. They're two different energies, the side of good, the side of bad, the side of kindness, the side of severity, etc., etc. But they're two different energies. It's a very common pattern in mystical thought. And obviously, one doesn't like to remain in a state of tension. One would like to see these ideas, especially in a mystical system, we'd like to see these energies presented as being at a state of reconciliation, a state of rest, and we call that a synthesis or a synthesis. So we have a thesis, antithesis, and a synthesis. Where everything gets funneled in the synthesis, everything gets funneled to a conclusion, which contains elements of the first two opposites, the positive and the negative, and then they combined and they are now at a happy state of existence, coexistence. So in the genre of Zoharic thought that deals with this idea, everyone's very familiar about, by the way, before we go into that, with the Hasidic notion, you've got Chesed, which is the right-hand side, the sound of compassion, mercy, juxtaposed against Gevura, the side of severity, and then they combine Chesed, Gevura, Tiferet. They combine in a state of beauty and harmony. Those two elements. And that pattern is repeated throughout the entire structure of the Eitz HaChaim, of the mystical tree of life. But the Zohar, interestingly enough, has a quite, the pattern is the same with those three elements, but has a very different conceptualization of those three energies. So it starts off by talking about din, which is interesting because din is judgment. Now, in the Hasidic model, din is usually the second element. It's the left side. It's the polar opposite of chesed, of kindness. You've got severity, because kindness wants to give, severity wants to withhold. So in the Hasidic model, we start with Chesed. In the Kabbalistic model, we started with Din, which is already a very interesting difference between modern Kabbalistic thought and classical Kabbalistic thought. But anyway, back to the Zohar. So we start off with Din. Din is judgment. We start with Din. Din becomes our thesis. That's the thesis. That's where we are presented with the notion of Din. That's the first element that exists. But obviously, that element needs to be managed, it needs to be channeled, it needs to be challenged if necessary. So we start with din. The next element that comes into play now, according to the Zohar, is rachamim, compassion. So we've got judgment and we have compassion. It makes sense. We've got two polar opposites. So we've got a thesis, judgment, din. We have our antithesis, which is rachamim, compassion. And now we're living in our state of tension between din and rachamim. And then the two form a synthesis eventually, and we get what's called chesed, which is mercy. So it's very different from the Hasidic model. Same ideas, but the structure is very, very much a different structure. We start with din, we move on to rachamim, and we end up with chesed as the synthesis. All right, so that becomes our pericope. That becomes so now if you're doing research into the Zohar, you'd go through the entire Zohar and you'd search and you'd look for from the published Zohar and from manuscripts, anything that deals with these three notions, and then you'd put them all in a compartment and you'd start analyzing them to see how do they differ, why do they differ. So to present this diagrammatically, we'd have din, starting off with din, we'd have rachamim on the other side, and then we'd have chesed in the middle, and that becomes our inverted triangle. And this seems to be the original Kabbalistic notion of this very model, of the structure of those three lines, of those three coven, with a thesis, antithesis, and the synthesis. It seems to be like a proto-Kabbalistic, an early Kabbalistic model of these three different energies, which become the building blocks, basically, of spirituality, the mechanics of spirituality. So that description that we've just been through now is found in one text of the Zohar. There are two other texts that deal with the same idea, but the model is different from the model that we've just presented. In the second and in the third variation of the same notion, talking about chesed, rachamim, etc., we have the following. The thesis remains din. So we always start with din. So almost in a sense, the creation is done with din. The first element is din. That's our thesis. Our thesis remains din throughout. So that's a common factor in this particular model. Din remains the thesis. We start with din. But then it's counteracted by its polar opposite, which is no longer rachamim like it was in the case of the first text. It now becomes chesed, which was the synthesis. So in the second version, the synthesis becomes the antithesis. So we have din on the one side, counteracted by chesed, and then the synthesis now becomes rachamim, which was the antithesis of the first text. So the other two texts adopt this particular model, which is a kind of a reversal of the order, although din remains the starting point. The only question is that the antithesis and the synthesis are swapped around. In the first case, it's rachamim, and in the second case, it's chesed, and rachamim becomes the synthesis in the second and third cases. In the third version, let's start with the second version. In the second version, if you look at the texts of the Zohar that discuss this. So the first version is rather sparse. That we mentioned, that was our core text. That seems to be the proto-Kabbalistic text where we had din, rachamim, synthesizing as chesed. That seems to be the original view of the Zohar. In that text, the text is very sparse. The mechanics are just simply presented to us. But in the second version, there's now an expansion into a narrative, in other words, into a story. Remember, the Zohar is basically a story about Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai and his friends wandering around Israel and discussing various things. So, the way the Zohar is presented very much in almost like a midrashic form, in the form of a narrative. But in the second version of our model, that narrative element is now expanded upon, and the narrative is enriched different aspects are added to the narrative. So the story becomes very, very important. Obviously, once we have a story, someone was walking down the road and they sat at a well, and someone else came and they asked a question. They said, when we introduce a whole narrative, the narrative takes on an importance of its own. It takes on a far greater importance. Hello, Adam. Welcome back. So nice of you to join us timelessly once again. All right. You can go back to your spaceship. So in the second narrative, or in the second version, the narrative is expanded upon almost to give it more authority, because it's now going against the model, the earlier model. It needs to be presented as being more authentic. And, you know, when we want to make something sound very chashuv in Judaism today, we say, well, I heard from Rav so-and-so, I heard it from so-and-so, and he told it to me when I was, you know, in such and such a place, and then no one can argue with that. And the Zohar seems to have adopted, or we've adopted that same kind of style by introducing this narrative, which imparts a degree of chashivus, especially when they change the model of the thesis, antithesis, and the synthesis. Okay. In the third version, the narrative, while embellished again, the language of the narrative has now changed from Hebrew to Aramaic. And obviously, you know what that means. By presenting the expanded narrative in Aramaic now, in the third version, not just in Hebrew as it was in the second version, one lends a degree of authority and authenticity. In other words, this would have been the language that would have been spoken in second century Eretz Israel, and thereby this second version of the model assumes a far greater degree of authenticity and importance. Now, obviously, if you just have one or two examples, you don't really see this, but when you see this repeated again and again in multiple patterns throughout the pericopes of the Zohar, they start to form a kind of a specific style which leads to certain conclusions. I'll give you a second example. This is a genre now that you find in the Zohar, which is called Yisrael Sava. It's a textual unit known as Yisrael Sava. This also appears in three different versions. Sometimes they appear in many, many versions, but in our examples now, there just happen to be three versions. They're both have three versions. This is a very significant textual unit, because one of the most important things that Kabbalah introduced to us, or the more modern Kabbalah, was the notion of the Sfirot. So while we find Sfirot mentioned previously before the Zohar, remember the Zohar was published in 1270. So when we talk about the Zohar, we are referring to the published date of the Zohar. However old the Zohar may have been or may not have been, it was published in 1270. But the Sfirot, the words Sfirot may have been used in the earlier mystical texts, but the concept of the Sfirot was popularized only from the time of the Zohar. So before the Zohar, yes, they used the word, but it didn't really mean what Sfirot mean today. So the Zohar was very key in establishing the dominance of the notion and the concept of the Sfirot. So now it's interesting to look at the textual layers of the Zohar where the Sfirot are discussed, to see how they introduce the notion of the Sfirot, and you know what they mean, and why was it necessary to suddenly have Sfirot in the conceptualization of the mechanics of the heavenly realm. So looking for clues to why Sfirot was introduced becomes quite an interesting enterprise. So the first two versions of this genre, Yisrael Sava, when we start speaking about Sfirot, or the mechanics of the heavenly realm, the first two versions actually do not speak about Sfirot. They don't speak about Sfirot. They discuss similar things, they discuss similar ideas to Sefirot, like the notion of Sefirot, but they don't use the word Sefirot. Instead, they use the word angels, and they refer to a kind of angelology. In other words, in the heavenly realm, there have to be, in the mystical perception, there have to be channels and pipes, and there has to be mechanics, a complicated hierarchy, so that the energy can flow left, right, center, up and down. Depending on what you do, you can move it here, you can move it there, you can manipulate it. Sometimes you are the victim of it, and then you need to extricate yourself from it. But you need to understand the complicated maze and web of the mechanics within the spiritual realm, the channels, the pipes, the ladders, the connections, the portals. So these are all described in the early texts, in the first two versions, as being angels. So the angels, and this appears to be the original view of the Zohar, no Sefirot yet. No, the Sefirot hadn't come about yet, as we understand them now. But the angels were doing what we later understood was done by the Sefirot. So angels and angelology became the mechanics of and the participants within and the channels within the heavenly realms, and depending on who the angels were and what they were called and what their functions were, the energy was able to move, and you would call on the angels instead of appealing to the various Sefirot. But it was all about angels. Those two versions are the earlier versions of this notion. The third version is a later version, and it's only in that later version that the word Sefirot, and remember, the word doesn't matter so much, it's the context where the Sefirot were presented as now taking over from the role that was previously believed to have been the a domain of the angels, was now taken over by the Sefirot. So now there was a concept not of angels existing, but of another kind of spiritual entity or different spiritual entities, which were spheres, heavenly spheres, which lend themselves more to the notion of channels and pipes and portals, the spheres, the Sefirot. So what do we see from this? We see that in the Zohar, which introduced the notion of the Sefirot, there was a development. At first, the Sefirot did not appear. There were angels who did the work of the Sefirot, but only in the later layers, or the later layer of the text, discussing these kind of mechanics, is it referred to as Sefirot. So the Sefirot are a later development of the Zohar. You only find that in the later strata of texts that deal with this particular topic, the notion of the Sefirot. But it's very significant to understand that the Sefirot didn't just come from the Zohar, that came from the later aspects of the Zohar, which shows that the Sefirot is a relatively newer concept, which was previously the domain of the angels. And interesting now, once again, we have a change in a proto-Kabbalistic view. In other words, the Kabbalah changes its original perception, as we saw in the previous example, where we also changed. If you remember, we changed the order of those three thesis, antithesis and the synthesis. Here too, we are changing from angels to Sefirot. So in the third version, suddenly the language changes. The language changes to Aramaic once again. So this seems to be the pattern that when you need to show a change, you need to show authenticity, and you need to show an ancient rooting of this idea. So the language of the narrative changes to Aramaic to lend it a more authentic, a sense of more authenticity. And also in the third version, where we introduce the Sefirot, suddenly now the narrative is expounded upon. And once again, this fits the pattern of our previous example as well. When you want to show the authority, you need to enhance and embellish the narrative, because you're showing that it's true, it existed, people who were alive at the time of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai were discussing this idea. So this, while it may look like a change, it's actually an authentic change. So to now, in our third version of where the Sefirot are introduced, the narrative is embellished, and also the stature of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai is enhanced. So what that does is it links this the introduction of the Sefira as opposed of the Sefirot as opposed to the angels. It links it to the authority or the authoritative figure of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, and it changes the narrative to the more ancient Aramaic, which again lends it a sense of authenticity. I'm going to conclude. There are many, many such examples. We're not going to go into it. And I'm thinking of maybe doing a part two to this year next week. We'll go into something else as well, similar to this. But basically what we've done today is we've looked at two examples of different textual layers, earlier texts, later texts. And what we can conclude, reasonably can conclude, is had the Zohar been written by one person? Look, obviously one person can change their mind, and people do change their minds. But when you see so many changes taking place, because it wasn't just one thing, and we've only done two examples, there are many, many such examples. When changes take place, and when it looks as if developments took place over centuries, because ideas were held for certain periods and we can identify more or less at what dates concepts changed, like the concept of Sefira would have been introduced later, the Sefirot. This again points to the notion of multiple authors, not just one author, and also points to the idea that it required time for these changes to ferment and for these changes to develop within the corpus of Kabbalistic writings. There are dozens of these layers and these units, and where I took my research from Meroz, that was in 2016, and as of 2016, Meroz had studied 32 such textual units, 32. They were taken from different parts of the Zohar, but they're also taken from the printed Zohar, but they're also taken from manuscripts that you won't find in the printed Zohar, and they were analyzed as well. And the results were fascinating. It's a fascinating methodology when it comes to the studying of the Zohar. Not too many people have looked at the Zohar in this way, and it's opened up such an interesting field of study, which Meroz refers to as the archaeology of the Zohar, because you really are digging up different layers and you're looking at what the layers are saying at those various times, and then you're comparing them to the same textual layers, to the same concepts where the same ideas are discussed in the printed version, maybe hundreds of pages later, and then seeing what is said over there, but analyzing these under the microscope and looking at how they correspond and how they differ, they reveal a tremendous amount of how these ideas were developed, and we'd even give you some ideas to what time they developed, what ideas were being spoken about in other parts of Jewish literature at that time, and even in the general world population at the time. Ideas that were prevalent at certain times were less prevalent at other times. And when one can start piecing together, it's a painstaking task, but one can start piecing together ideas, especially when you're working within patterns. So obviously you can't just do this with one or two examples. You need to have a look at a large body of data, collection of data, in order to begin to draw certain conclusions. So what we do see is we see that the idea of literary enhancements, because in one place the idea would be presented very sparsely, in another place it'd be like a whole story and just the core of the idea would be woven into the story almost incidentally. This shows a kind of a editorial process where one wants to create a sense of authenticity. There'd be framing narratives, which you'd find in certain sections, but you won't find them in other sections. There'd be stylistic embellishments. And again, you'd look where were the stylistic embellishments used as opposed to just a raw presentation of the ideas. Psychological insights, in other words, sometimes ideas were so important that you had to learn things from them. And also, these were then related back to the participants in some of the texts. They were related very much to individual participants. So one rabbi would say this, and another rabbi, part of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's group, as it was presented, would say something else. And so the ideas were kind of fleshed out and took on almost a personality of their own. The various protagonists of the Zohar would represent different ideas. And by reading those ideas within that particular context, it all related to an authenticity, a presented authenticity of second century, of a second century literature. What I think is most significant of the study, and with this we will conclude, is that the besides being taken out of the binary box that it always was in, you know, was it Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, was it Moshe Dilyon? What we've done over here is we've dispelled that notion in a sense. We've opened it up and we've placed the development of the Zohar between the 11th and the 14th century, which is round about the time of Moshe Dilyon. Moshe Dilyon died, I think, in 1305. But it places that around that particular time. So we've removed that classical binary debate of the authorship of the Zohar. But what we've also done, and this is what I think is most significant, is we've turned more towards a model of multiple authors. In other words, not just Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai or Moshe Dilyon, multiple authors. But number three, what we've done is we've shown, or Meroz rather has shown, that besides all of that, this all took place over an extended period of at least 300 years from the 13th to the 14th century, which is where the origins of the Zohar are, according to this research, is now placed based on the evidence to date. Because such an evolution, by adding literary embellishments, by adding stories, by changing language, by moving from angelology to sfirot, is not something that can happen in a short period of time. This shows evidence of a lengthy evolution. It didn't just happen in one short period of time. So even if you want to say it was Moshe Dilyon, it couldn't have been just Moshe Dilyon. There were many authors, multiple authors, over quite a few centuries that appear to have been working on the Zohar as we know it, because in Meroz's words, so many changes could only have occurred over a long period of time. So there we have a brief presentation of this research, and it opens very interesting possibilities, and it maybe corrects some of our previously held views, or certainly challenges them, or certainly becomes interesting and necessary of noting. I thank you very much for listening, and look forward to seeing you again next time.